to some of us, I think. That is very good. Thank you very much. Is it Ms. Marika?
Baritza.
Baritza. Good morning to you.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Bonnie Baritza, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Stacy Ryan. She was an intervener in this matter in the District Court of Harpy County. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. There's a lot of background in this case, and there's related instances that have been on appeal. There's another case that's currently on appeal. I can call in about a month. But I've tried to articulate an issue for the court to get the argument started today. That kind of, as narrowly as I could, given all the background and all the facts. But the issue in my mind is this. Can a member of a limited liability company intervene into a case where the plaintiff is seeking to buy out the sole asset of that limited liability company, and the managers of the company have not done anything to defend the case or to respond to the allegations of the plaintiff's case, and instead they've come before the district court and asked it to appoint a receiver to handle defense of the case?
Did the parties agree to the appointment of a receiver?
The two managers, who are not parties to the case, came before the district court and jointly applied for the receiver to be appointed.
And now one of them objects to what the receiver is doing.
Well, my client is a member of the LLC, so she was not part of the application to appoint the receiver. And so she did not receive any notice of the application to appoint the receiver. She didn't know that was going to be happening. She didn't receive an order of the court. There were no meetings of the managers or meetings of the members of the limited liability to discuss how to handle the lawsuit that was brought against the company.
Do the receivership statutes require the kind of notice that you're suggesting?
The receivership statutes require notice to all affected parties. And so we have a limited liability company with six members. It's a family-owned company. It was established by Dr. Ryan. And the only other members are his five adult children. And so all of those members are affected parties under the receivership statutes.
Under the operating agreement of this particular LLC, it is manager-operated, correct? And was Ms. Ryan a manager?
No, Ms. Ryan is not a manager. But an argument that we made to the district court and what we alleged in our complaint and intervention is that those two managers, by appearing before the district court and asking the court to appoint a receiver, basically indicated they were not willing to act as managers anymore and shirked their duties in that regard. And so for that reason, Ms. Ryan, the appellant here, had no ability to confer with the managers on the decision to ask for a receiver to be appointed, determine what kind of defense was going to happen in the case. And so on those facts...
So is the focus of the complaint and intervention to make a collateral attack on the order appointing the receiver?
That was one of them.
Right.
That was one of the main things.
And would that expand the scope of the litigation?
I don't think so, because I think it's fundamental that once a receivership has been appointed, if there are problems with how that receiver was appointed or statutory problems with the receivership itself, such as lack of notice, such as lack of a bond, those are the things that she's alleged, that receivership is void under the statutes. And so if the managers of the LLC aren't going to come in and say there's something wrong, and obviously here they weren't because they asked for the receiver, then the members have a right to come in to protect their interests in that.
Grounded in what? Give me a statute or give me a case.
It's grounded in the case law that we cited in our brief. And so one case is the Bugbee case. It's an older case of this court. But in that case, there was a receivership appointed over a corporation, and interveners came in and alleged that their interests were not being adequately protected by the receiver, and so they were allowed to intervene. And it was a question of the sufficiency of their allegations in the intervention. But we haven't gotten to any facts or evidence in this case. I mean, really, we're just looking at the sufficiency of what's been alleged in the intervention, and is that enough to allow her, Ms. Ryan, to intervene into the case, develop evidence, conduct discovery.
Is the order denying intervention a final appealable order?
It is, Your Honor. I think both sides agree that an order striking or denying an intervention is certainly a final order. There's been a jurisdiction question raised in the case about whether the Nebraska Revised Statute 25-13-15 had to be complied with here by the district court, and whether in order to stay the district court's proceedings and get jurisdiction, the district court had to make an express determination that there was no reason for undue delay in raising an appeal. In the briefing, I pointed this court to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54B and several federal appeals courts that have looked at that issue and said this kind of statute does not apply when a party appeals a denial of an intervention. 54B is essentially the same as 25-13-15. This court has said that it looks to that statute, the federal statute, when it interprets 25-13-15. And so based on that law, I don't think that there was any reason that the district court had to include that language from the Nebraska statute in its order before we were able to appeal the denial of the intervention here and this court gained jurisdiction.
Your premise that it is a final appealable order, assuming I buy in with the 25-13-15 argument, is premised on what prong of Section 25-1902?
On what prong?
Yes. It's not a special proceeding.
Right, it's not a special proceeding.
And it's not a summary application after judgment.
I'm not sure that 1902...
What other source would there be of a final? It's clearly not a judgment. You haven't gotten... There's no judgment.
Well, we've relied on case law that has... of this court and of the Nebraska Court of Appeals that has said that a denial or an order striking a complaint and intervention is a final order and is immediately appealable. And so one of the cases is this In Re Little Blue Natural Resources District.
And what did the court hang its hat on there?
I think it...
It just said it's appealable.
Well...
Did it refer to a statute?
I suppose it must have referred to 25-1902, and I may be not recalling the other prongs there, but there was clear statements there that the denial of the intervention was a final order. And it's something I guess we didn't get into in depth in our briefing because both sides have agreed that it is a final order. It's something I could certainly provide the court with more authority on if that's something that you'd like us to look more in depth into.
Thank you.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Is it Ms. Butter or Ms. Buter?
Ms. Buter.
Ms. Buter, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Victoria Buter. I'm along with my co-counsel, Ronald Reagan. We represent the Appellee Streck, Inc. in this case. I think it probably makes sense to start by addressing the jurisdictional question that was raised by Your Honor in this particular matter. We have raised the statute 25-13-15 in this case because there really hasn't been an analysis done by this court in the event that there's an intervention is denied, and an appeal is had.
You agree with your opposing counsel that this fits into a 25-1902, or that somehow there's some other basis for it to be a final appealable order?
We agree that there is case law that suggests that this is a final appealable order from which a purported intervener can appeal.
And what does your understanding of the case law tell you about the source of that case law?
We really do not believe there was much analysis that was actually completed in those cases. And one of the reasons that we raise the issue, because it is an interesting issue for litigants right now in the state of Nebraska, is whether or not this statute should be complied with. And that, we submit, would allow a district court to have some control over his or her docket in the event that we have a belated attempted intervention that, in this particular case, for example, the intervener came in approximately 2 weeks before trial was supposed to start, intervened. We submit the district court appropriately and properly said the intervener had no right to do so. That was denied, and that created an immediately appealable issue, which in the state of Nebraska divest the district court from jurisdiction of everything else.
So your case right now is in limbo pending the resolution of this particular issue. And what remedy would the party who wanted to intervene have if the case went on and there was ordered specific performance and that was done? What right would the intervener have then to make any claim with regard to the issue of specific performance under the contract?
We would believe that at the time that the issue has been decided, in other words, there's a final appealable judgment that's been entered as to the entire case, at that time the intervener can certainly come forward and make his or her arguments as to why they should have been permitted to intervene. It would be in the purview of the district court to make a determination as to whether or not the district court wanted the underlying case to go forward.
And if you were trying to examine the abstract of title to determine whether or not there was valid title in the property, would you have to wait until there was a final determination of that appeal?
Would the intervener have mm-hmm. to wait? No, I believe that the intervener can raise that issue during the appeal of any substantive issue that would occur.
Counsel, what does this court's decision in Guardian Tax Partners, that recent decision, what does that do to your analysis of 25-1315?
You know, that was a situation involving, if I recall, partition of property and title there, and we do not believe that that has really any direct impact into the argument we're making here. The argument we're making here is in the case of a narrow situation of an intervention, a very late intervention, can it be that the district court will be able to determine that it can expressly direct in its order whether or not it's a final order that should be immediately appealable or not. And we do not believe that the Guardian case that you referred to that I did review has any bearing on the actual argument that we're making.
What do our intervention statutes tell us about the timing of a judge's decision with respect to a complaint and intervention?
So the statute itself states that, that an intervener can intervene if they have an interest in the outcome of the case. The case law has interpreted that as a direct and legal interest as a matter of right prior to trial commencing.
And when should a court rule on that complaint and intervention?
The cases have held that the court can rule on that complaint and intervention initially to determine the threshold issue. In other words, the threshold issue of whether that statutory requirement is met, i.e. does the intervener have that requisite direct and legal interest? And that can be ruled upon at any time.
What does the statute require with respect to decision making?
The statute itself doesn't address that issue, as I recall.
Thank you.
So we would submit that, one issue I do want to raise,
I'm sorry, going back, is your main complaint here that this was so late in the process that it should be denied?
Well, we have two real reasons we believe this should have been denied. First of all, we do not believe that the appellant here has the requisite standard under the intervention statute. She does not have a direct and legal interest in the outcome of this actual case. That's our first argument. Our second argument is certainly with regard to the untimeliness of this purported intervention. And I will certainly address the merits of that. I would like to clarify one issue, if that's okay, regarding the jurisdictional issue that we have raised. The federal case law that has been cited to that would suggest that our rule is very similar to Rule 54B of the federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that is distinguishable for one very significant reason. And that is, in federal court, when somebody attempts to intervene and that intervention is denied or ruled upon, the intervener can indeed appeal at that time. But the main difference here is in federal court, the federal district court does not automatically lose jurisdiction over the rest of the case. The federal district court can make a determination that it will proceed with the remainder of the case. And in Nebraska, while that issue hasn't been directly decided, the case law would suggest that that is not the case. The district court does lose jurisdiction over everything, which leads to the delays that we have in this case and in another case that's going to be pending before this court shortly.
Well, doesn't this person have an interest in whether or not the business is sold or the property is sold or retained?
We would submit no, Your Honor, that the district court correctly denied the intervention, and this is why. What the appellant is really advocating here is a general and sweeping position by this court that any member of any company can at any time intervene in a piece of litigation the company is involved in just because they're a member. And there's absolutely no authority that has been cited for that broad and sweeping proposition before this court. And I would briefly like to distinguish the two cases that have been cited here by the appellant. The first one is the Bugby case, and that is not a case where the court appointed a receiver to act on behalf of the corporation. To the contrary, the case is very clear that the corporation was not represented in that case, and that is why the court allowed the intervention of a member in that case.
So if this case went to completion and the property was sold and the title was transferred, at that time the intervener could take an appeal from the denial of intervention with regard to that particular property?
They could. If the case went forward and was tried, the intervener was denied, the case went forward and was tried, and it was determined that the property, which is in the name of the company, not of the individual members, right, should have been sold to Streck and should be sold to Streck, then yes, there could be an appeal at that point of the issue of intervention. That's what the intervener would have standing to appeal from.
And if the court then found that the appellate court found that the should have been granted intervention, then what would be the remedy for the intervener?
I think the question or the analysis would then be whether or not there was any issue or error that took place as a result of that individual not being a party. If there was none, obviously there would be no issue. If there was, that would probably result in a retrial, which is not ideal. We understand that.
Okay.
The second case that is cited by the appellants for their broad and sweeping proposition, and I would just like to distinguish this briefly, is the Rizika case. And that is a case where this court did allow intervention of an individual, but that was specifically because the court found that the individual had title to the property at issue. And that is not the case that we have here. We have a situation where the Ryan Family LLC owns this property. Ms. Ryan is not a managing member of that LLC. She has no managerial responsibilities whatsoever as it pertains to this LLC. She is simply a member. And at the end of the day, this case is about whether or not the property should be sold. If the property is sold to Streck, the LLC will be in possession of a very large sum of cash. What that LLC decides to do with that cash, as it implicates the members individually, has nothing to do with what is actually going on in this case. This case is about the possible sale of property to Streck. So the other issue I'd like to briefly, quickly address is the fact that the timing of this was completely belated in terms of the intervention. And this court has held in the past that an unreasonable delay in waiting to try to intervene is grounds for the court to, in his or her discretion, deny that intervention.
Haven't our discussions of that issue been in equitable intervention cases and not statutory intervention cases?
I think that the discussions have been in both. I would respectfully submit there is issues or discussions about timeliness in both situations. In fact, the Court of Appeals has stated that, and I'll quote from a Court of Appeals case, Association of Commonwealth Claimants versus Hick, that persons who would otherwise be granted leave to intervene are denied consideration where they sit by and allow litigation to proceed without reasonably requesting leave to enter the case. We would submit that that is what we have here. Even if you were to find she had some kind of interest that could be asserted here, to wait until after the receiver was appointed. And I would like to note that on page 8 of Ms. Ryan's opening brief, she admits she was attending or at a hearing where the appointment of this receiver in this case was discussed. She did have notice of it. She was aware of that. We've argued the rest of the time in this argument in our brief. I know we're out of time, and we would respectfully request that the court affirm the ruling of this report and deny intervention.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
There is 2 minutes, 23 seconds.
2 minutes and 23 seconds, Ms. Boritza.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start sort of where Ms. Peter left off on the timeliness issue, and our position is that the timeliness concern is governed by the statute here, because Ms. Ryan had a right to intervene under the statute. There's cases from this court that say that that's an absolute right under the statute, and so the timeliness argument doesn't come unless you're using the equity basis for intervening, which is developed under case law rather than the statute. And so the statute says that a party who has a direct legal interest intervene into a case before the trial, and that's what she did here. So there is no timeliness issue. Even if the court were to look at kind of the equitable factors, Ms. Ryan alleged all of the reasons why she wasn't able to intervene right when the case was filed or shortly thereafter. She alleged those in her complaint. having an intervention, and we submitted an affidavit of evidence where she went through the efforts that she had undertaken with the receiver to learn what was going on with the case, learn what defenses it was going to assert from LLC, figure out whether her interests were going to be protected. So that is all evidence that was before the district court, and there was no evidence in opposition to any of that. And in fact, at the district court level, the argument on the timeliness was not even made, and so it was made for the first time on appeal. In the district court, Streck didn't oppose the intervention in any way. They haven't done that until the appeal of the case. And so the district court entered a ruling denying the intervention, but didn't specify that timeliness was high or any reasons for it.
What's your best argument that Ms. Ryan, that Stacey Ryan has a direct and legal interest sufficient to support statutory intervention?
She has a direct and legal interest based on the income that she'll receive, that she currently receives from rent, and income that she'll receive from the sale of that property. That's sufficient to be a direct and legal interest under the statute.
So would you argue that every member of the LLC has that same interest?
I'll answer it this way. I'm not arguing for a broad rule that Ms. Buter tried to kind of force on us up here. I'm arguing that under the specific facts of this case, where a member of a limited liability company has tried to figure out what's going on, has tried to protect her interests, and the managers of that company have basically shirked their duties and asked for a receiver to be appointed. In those kinds of cases where you can make those allegations, and we even offered evidence of that, that's sufficient to show the direct and legal interest, because the managers haven't been protecting your interest and the receiver hasn't been doing it.
Is Stacey Ryan's interest, as you describe it, any different from the other members of the LLC?
Same as the other four members who have the same 19.8% ownership, but different than Dr. Ryan, who has a very small ownership interest, and I would say different than the two managers of the LLC, who basically said, we can't do anything, we can't manage this LLC anymore, please appoint a receiver.
And under the operating agreement, do any of the non-managing members have the legal right to speak on behalf of the LLC or make decisions for the LLC?
Not under the operating agreement. I mean, but we're arguing under case law. You know, in the corporation context, Closely Held Corporation context, limited liability company context, if the managers or the receiver or the company is not protecting a shareholder or a member, then that member has the right to allege that and intervene to protect the interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. Court is adjourned and you are excused.